my name's Martin Wallacott. I'm on The Guardian. I write leaders these days, but in a previous incarnation, I was occasionally in the Middle East, where amongst other legendary characters, I first met Charlie. I can attest to his long attachment to the region. In fact, he's even a sort of Syrian himself, in at least half of his family. I can attest to his physical courage, his leadership, his perception, and to a certain inner seriousness which belies his rather jokey exterior. He's written a very concise book which is in a sense an analysis of the Syrian situation and a lament for a Syria that could have been and that perhaps existed or began to exist at various points in the past, but which now seems enormously distant from us today, a Syria where there would be a pluralist and tolerant society presided over by an effective but democratic state. I remember reading many years ago Olivia Manning's trilogy about the Levant, in which at one point the heroine goes to Damascus, where she's taken up by a young Syrian Christian student who takes her around Damascus and eventually takes her to a party. This would be, I suppose, about 1944. French were still around, but their days were numbered. And at the party, there are Christians, Muslims, Jews, young men, and even a few young women from the high middle class of Damascus, all talking about the collective ideas they were all having about the future of Syria, ideas that were soon to be dashed to the ground, as it were. So that is one moment when the mirage of a better Syria emerged. There are two other moments. One is most recently when this uprising began, and it seemed possible perhaps to outside observers who were far too optimistic about it, and to some Syrians who were far too optimistic about it, that a change was in progress, a revolution was in progress that would lead to an incredibly required and needed renewal of Syrian society and politics. That emphatically did not happen. Indeed, exact opposite has happened. That's one moment. And then there's another moment to which Charlie refers in this book. It's kind of the way he bridges the situation between the early 20th century and the early 21st century, is the great revolt of the 20s, when, just as now, there was a rising which was many-headed, which could never get its act together, which was influenced by outside forces, which also were very unclear about what they wanted, and which was eventually put down by the French, in part because of its disunity, and also in part because it never captured the loyalties of a very substantial part of the population, which stayed willy-nilly with the powers that be. So I'd like to begin by asking Charles whether he would explore for us for a minute or two or longer that parallel between, I suppose it's between then and now, I suppose it's 70 or 80 years, those similarities and those differences.
We have to take turns with this mic, it's the only microphone, so pass it back. The Great Revolt of 1925 began almost in the same place that the revolt of 2011 began, in the area around Dara, in the foothills of the Jebel Druze, with misbehavior by a local governor. When France occupied Syria in 1920, it divided Syria into four states, an Alawite state, a Druze state, an Aleppo state, and a Damascus state, without ever consulting the local population about whether they want these divisions involved. These divisions were very much resented. In any case, the Druze, not unusually in their history, could not, when their leader died, they had a local constituent assembly. It was entitled to choose their own governor from among their own people, but because two rival Druze families couldn't agree on who that person should be, they asked a French officer to become the governor, the local governor. And then he instituted some reforms that they didn't like, which basically he was a very progressive French Republican who wanted to have land reform and dispossess the Druze aristocracy, which was not at all popular. But in any case, this unpopular governor, the French stood by him, and an uprising began. Well, the same thing happened in 2011 when some students put some graffiti on the wall in Dara, and an anti-regime graffiti, and the children were arrested, and they were tortured. And so the families of these children demonstrated in the streets, because torturing children, even in Syria, is something, it's a red line that you can't cross. And adults have been tortured for ages, but children was a little bit much. The French, in 1925, stood by their governor and wouldn't replace him, and so the Druze rose up, and they were joined by Bedouin tribes in the region, and then a parallel uprising began in Homs at the same time in 1925, and it looked like the whole country was about to slip from France's grasp. Well, in 2011, instead of getting rid of the governor, Bashar al-Assad kept him and used his father's technique, which is force, to try and quell the demonstrations. Immediately, Homs rose up, just as it had in 1925, and the fire spread to the rest of the country. Then, in 1925, the Syrian rebellion was co-opted by outside powers, by neighboring states, particularly Saudi Arabia, which didn't have the money, the oil money that it has now, but it still was able to send Wahhabi fighters up to the country, to send weapons, and to turn it from a Syrian uprising into a Wahhabi uprising. And this was, in a way, its undoing. Similarly, after 2011, the Saudis, who now have much more money and much more clout than they did in 1925, were able to do the same thing by 10, so that the uprising, which began first as a peaceful movement, which began as a secular movement that included people of all sects, including Alawis, was turned into a jihad, a Wahhabi jihad, and which alienated all those people who were not, by definition, permitted to participate in a jihad. I mean, I talked to Alawi and Druze friends who were initially for the revolution, but now say, how can we support a revolution that threatens our very existence? It's not possible anymore. And so Assad is behaving much as the French behaved in 1925, and the jihadists are behaving much as their forebears did in 1925. I think that was in a way the undoing of what could have been a decent popular insurrection.
Thanks, Charlie. Can I follow through by asking another question, which is related to that, and that is why the young Assad had not learned any of the lessons which you lay out in this book? Why the recourse to force had to be so absolute? Why there seemed to be no alternative policy within the Alawite or within the Damascus establishment? Or perhaps I should ask a separate question and throw that in as well. Do we know anything about the question of whether alternatives were discussed and pursued in Damascus, whether within the establishment, within Bashar Assad's, and of course he's not the only actor in this, other members of his family are as powerful or perhaps more powerful, whether within that group there was some discussion of a more moderate response to what was going on. After all, 1920s is one thing, and the early 21st century is another. And this might rephrase the question by saying, how did a mild-mannered eye doctor become a killer?
You're right. In the early stages, we know from some defectors from the regime, and also from Wafiq Saeed, a businessman here, who met with Bashar early in the uprising and tried to, in order to win British support for a compromised solution in Syria, tried to persuade Bashar to accept certain constitutional changes and a a more open political system in which there would be elections that he theoretically could lose, although in practice he could probably still rig them the way elections in Cook County, Illinois, are rigged. Bashar, Rafiq Saeed said that Bashar gave him his word that he was going to address Parliament and introduce reforms. A week passed, Bashar addressed the Parliament, and not one reform was mentioned. It was all a narrative that Syria is threatened by outside terrorists and jihadists. The country is about to be destroyed, and we must crush them. And that was the end of any hope within the regime. And I've spoken to some who've now fled to Dubai, who were involved in those discussions, and they said that the Maher al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad were adamant that there could not be compromise. And the lesson that they remember was Hama in 1982, when his father was not willing to compromise with the Muslim Brothers, rightly or wrongly, but that rebellion was crushed in one go. The rebellion had begun slowly in 1979 in Aleppo, spread to Hama, and we have to remember that the Muslim Brothers, the reason they were rebelling was because Hafez al-Assad had introduced universal compulsory education for women. So it was the Muslim Brothers' cause was not one that all Syrians supported by any means, including not all Sunnis. So it was much easier for the father to crush them because people were 9 years into the Assad regime, which was 9 years longer than almost any regime from 1949 to 1970 had ever lasted. I think that they were afraid of losing that continuity, and so they did support the government, even though 10,000 people were killed. In that family, I think the lesson is that Hama won, and the way to deal with the rebellion was to crush it.
Well, that's a very convincing answer, but I would just... Sorry, is that okay? I'll just open it out a little bit by saying, why didn't the regime, which ostensibly was a secular regime, had its roots in the Ba'ath Party, why didn't it recognize a commonality of interests or at least of attitude with an uprising or series of demonstrations, which is all it was at that stage, which was essentially secular? It was about political rights conceived of in a secular way. These were not the reactionary Muslim rebels of 20 years before. These were a new kind of people, a new Syria, with which a secular regime like Assad's should have been counting on as at least neutral and possibly as potential allies if it had had in mind that Islamist danger which had been demonstrated before. So it learned the wrong lesson, I suppose, is the answer.
I think that is not... You can get an idea of it. If you've ever gone into Syria by land from Lebanon or Turkey or Jordan, and you see how officials treat people when they try to come into their own country, how they make them wait for hours, how they abuse them, how they demand money from them, there is an arrogance that goes with the power there. And it goes right from the bottom to the top of the system. And one of the things that people were demanding, probably more than freedom, was dignity, just to be treated fairly. And the regime had never done that. And that seems to be embedded in the system.
I'm shifting around a little here, but in one of your previous books, you explain, as I understood it anyway, how interesting and also enlightening it was for you to realize that even in a liberal Arab family, a patriarch was peeping around the door. In other words, that the attitudes which were manifest at governmental level, including the attitudes you've just talked about, were often replicated all the way down the line. So I suppose the question is this: is it too simple to see this as a clash between democratic or democratically inclined young people, new people, and a reactionary regime? Is there the seed of this in every Arab household? Is there something in the structure of society which ensures a replication at every level of the attitudes which are at the center of political failure in Syria and other Arab countries?
there is much reinforcement of the father in the society, and there's much reinforcement from the mosque, particularly of those in power. I mean, you go to the mosque on Friday. I remember a friend of mine in Gaza telling me, you used to go to the mosque on Friday, and the preacher would tell you that you're worthless, and you must thank God that you have Gamal Abdel Nasser or Yasser Arafat to protect you. And this message, it reverberates throughout the society at all levels, and it doesn't help in terms of transformation of society or in terms of empowering young people or empowering women. It's something that, as people have better education and see the world more, and their society is open to the world more, that change can happen in evolutionary terms, not revolutionary terms. But right now, it's in the middle of a war. There's not going to be any development at all.
Can we turn now to the outside actors, their part in the creation, perhaps not the creation, but the perpetuation of this conflict and its growth from something relatively small and perhaps containable and perhaps resolvable into something that seems none of those things today? And in particular, I'm thinking about the United States, which at a very early stage, it seems to many of us, decided it would indicate very clearly that Assad had to go, the Assad regime had to go. When it did that, it forfeited any pretensions it might have had to be, not a mediator exactly, but to be regarded as, in any sense, a neutral party, or to be diplomatically useful, having declared itself so completely against the government in Damascus. Despite its sins, which were many by that time, it threw away a diplomatic card. And how critical was that piece of irresponsibility?
I think it was even more critical than that, because along with that decision to say Assad must go, which meant that there was nothing for him to negotiate, they began arming the opposition. And they encouraged their allies, with their client states of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, to arm the opposition and turn it from an uprising or a rebellion, or I should say, from peaceful demonstrations to war. And that was a strategy that many of the young people in Damascus were against from the very beginning. They knew they would lose a war. They knew the country would be destroyed in a war. They thought that the regime was not prepared for peaceful demonstrations, wasn't prepared for general strikes, wasn't prepared for sanctions that would come as popular forces around the world supported them. And so the U.S., in arming the revolution, helped to bring about a situation where compromise became less and less likely. And also that fulfilled Bashar's judgment, or I should say, propaganda statement at the beginning, that this was a jihadist uprising and not a democratic uprising, and that these people were terrorists and so forth. That became his self-fulfilling prophecy, thanks to the actions of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. But we've seen now the consequences of that. If the United States, which wanted to get rid of Bashar primarily, not because he was a dictator, because the United States supports Arab dictators everywhere, not because he was a dictator, but because of his relationship with Iran, and also he was a Russian ally. He's the only ally the Russians have in the Arab world. The Americans have the rest. So the Russians weren't going to give that up easily, but they might be persuaded in discussions, if they were willing to discuss it with the Iranians and the Russians, to have had a compromise whereby Iran and Russia tell Assad, because without their money, he's finished, that he has to have a period of transition. And by the same token, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Qatar could tell the other side that they're going to be cut off if they don't agree to accept him for a transitional period. That there was a possibility when they went to Geneva the second time that they could have done that, but the Russians and the Americans, because of Ukraine, weren't speaking to each other. So it didn't go anywhere.
You assigned to the Americans, as it were, the primary role in the missing of that window rather than the secondary role. But let me ask you now, leaving the Americans aside, what motivates the outside actors? Let me put that in a broader way. you could say that the ambitions of both Iran and Saudi Arabia to dominate the Central Middle East are misguided, and would appear misguided to any sensible person, any rational person in either Iran or Saudi Arabia. And I can't think it's possible to deny that there are rational people in both those countries. Iran is ill-equipped to strive for such a mastery because it's in the wrong religion, as it were. Saudi Arabia is ill-equipped to strive for that mastery because it's too small a country. Despite its vast geographical size, it doesn't have the resources, and it doesn't have the sophistication to aspire to such things. So you've got two countries which have no real chance of achieving mastery over the area in which they're contesting it. Mm-hmm. Now, how and why is this happening? And what do we know, if anything, of the kind of discussions that might be going on in Iran, which is slightly more open than Saudi, or even in Saudi? The question of the new king, of course, comes in here. What do we know about that question of whether there's any discussion in those countries or any grasp at any level of how foolish this conflict is?
Well, we know a bit more today than we did a week ago because of the WikiLeaks, Saudi cables leaked. And if you go to the WikiLeaks site and you put Syria for the Saudi cable, you have thousands of cables. They were absolutely obsessed with Iran's role in Syria. And they were willing, just as the Iranians on the other side were willing to destroy Syria to deny it to the other side. And that is what is happening. The Iranians are willing to destroy it to deny it to the Saudis. The Saudis are willing to destroy it to deny it to the Iranians. And the Syrians don't get a look in. They're being driven out to Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey. The obsession seems to be part of the Wahhabi ideology that the Shias don't have the right to dominate anywhere. And they don't want them in power in Baghdad. They don't want them in power in Damascus. And they certainly don't want Hezbollah to be in Lebanon annoying the Sunnis of Lebanon, because traditionally the Saudis, they replace Nasser as the protectors of the Sunnis in Lebanon. And so you have this all the way from the Mediterranean to the borders of Iran, the Saudis trying to deny the Iranians control of those areas, and the Iranians trying to have them.
In a way, it's very reminiscent of the Cold War, which was also an exercise in trying to deny the other side, constantly trying to deny the other side positions of advantage, but which was occasionally modified and moderated by clever and sensible and rational people like George Kennan, who said, look, neither side can win this, and this is going to be a long standoff in which we should behave prudently rather than aggressively. We both have these obsessions about the other side, but they can be contained. Containment was not only a containment of the Soviet Union, in Kennan's view, it was a containment of the worst side of America's aggressive instincts, as it were. These two countries, Saudi Arabia and Iran, are locked in a battle that they can't win, but they're also trying to deny to each other victories which neither side could win, at least not on a permanent basis. It seems to me that in the philosophical sense, and that's a fairly useless sense, but nevertheless it's worth exploring for a second or two, in a philosophical sense, this is the basic problem now. How do these two countries come to a more realistic understanding the limits of their ambitions and the limits of the ambitions of the other side? The Saudis understand that there's no way the Iranians could in any way permanently dominate the Central Middle East, and vice versa.
Well, on the Iranian side, Iran is an independent country and it doesn't have a superpower that can guide it. So it has to be a political debate within the Iranian establishment. In Saudi Arabia, there's the hand of the United States, which can control what the Saudis do. I mean, the Saudis, to go back into the history of the relationship between the Saudis and the U.S., from the time of the Nasser's revolution in Egypt in 1952, the U.S. was willing to use the Saudis to finance the Muslim Brothers in Syria and in Egypt and similar movements throughout the first the Arab and then the greater Islamic world. as a way of defeating local progressive forces and of checking the Soviets and checking Soviet influence. So they created some of the most reactionary movements in the world, using the Saudis, using Saudi money, Saudi propaganda, Saudi mosques, Saudi mullahs, which now are very, very strong everywhere, including here. I mean, this was a creation of the United States and Saudi Arabia in the Cold War, which has outlasted the Cold War, and I think has certainly outlasted its usefulness. However, it's not going to go away, and the United States is not showing any sign of reining that in Syria or anywhere else, when it should. But without that guiding hand to draw it in, they'll go on doing it.
Well, in pursuit of that, do you see any prospect that President Clinton, possibly chastened by experience over the years, possibly not, might change these things?
Does anyone watch John Stewart?
Yes.
Did you see his program on the Middle East the other night? Going on and on about the history that we're repeating these mistakes, and then he came up with his chant. In the Middle East, learning curves are for pussies. And the United States has shown again and again, no matter how many times they get it wrong, they're going to do it again.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Another way is to say that the United States never makes the same mistakes. It makes different mistakes. I'd like to bring this back to something which sustains Charlie's book, which is not about geopolitics, although it touches on that sort of thing, and it's not so much about history, although it touches on that. It's essentially a human reaction to a tragedy, and an attempt to make clear to people outside the region, people in the West particularly, how utterly terrible it is. I'd like to ask Charlie why there seems to be, as I think a recent report said, we seem to be so inured, we seem to be in Europe and America so insulated from the tragedy of what's going on. We see it in many ways, the refusal to take refugees, the lack of interest. I several times Googled Syria when I was doing my homework for this, and I was amazed about how little recently there has been. It's become almost a back subject unless something particularly atrocious happens. Why have we gone into this mode? We're in a kind of denial about the situation.
Well, in all wars that you've covered, I've covered in the Balkans or in Lebanon, you know that the longer it goes on, the harder it is for you to get your piece of the paper.
Yeah.
Because people lose interest, unless there's some major development. I mean, for example, the destruction of Palmyra has attracted a lot of attention because many people know it, and it is a horrible thing. But then weeks will go by where we don't hear very much. Partly because the situation isn't really going anywhere, and so it'll get back on the front page when there's a development that may or may not mean something. And that's just, I think that's part of the normal news cycle.
Well,
but I think it's in this case it's particularly dangerous. I mean, we're looking at the number of Syrians who have had to flee their country. I mean, now soon there'll probably be a Syrian majority in Lebanon,
yeah.
And Jordan is taking in a million people, more 1.8 million. Turkey's taking in people. Iraq not, because Iraq's in as bad a shape as Syria. But those kinds of numbers will rebound. Remember, in 1948. 750,000 Palestinians, only 750,000. We're not talking about 6 or 8 million like the Syrians are, but 750,000 defined the entire Middle East from 1948 until now. And the consequences of that displacement of those people from the Middle East and the world still living with. And if this goes on in Syria and it gets much worse and more people flee, it will be a breeding ground for such violence and such horror that you won't imagine the consequences. And those people will be on boats and trains and trucks coming here, seeking safety, but not all of them seeking safety.
Well, that's a very bleak thought, but it's also rather convincing. Sorry, it's a very bleak thought, but also rather convincing. Now you go back to the geopolitics for a minute or two. There have been some changes recently. You've already mentioned one, the change of regime in Saudi Arabia. It's been the Turkish election, Erdogan's failure to extend himself in a way that he wanted to. And there is also, on the Iranian side, it's not quite the same thing, but nevertheless, there's the possibility there will be a nuclear deal at the end of this month. So there are three major changes either happening or in prospect that could be deemed to... could be deemed to change the situation. They might shake up the kaleidoscope in such a way as to provide an opportunity, if you were being optimistic, an opportunity for something, or they might make it worse. But anyway, three changes that I'd like you to attend to. Are these three changes likely to make any serious difference?
Just because I was distracted by the first one, the second one was the change in Iran. First was the Turkish elections.
And Saudi King.
And Saudi King.
Three changes in the outside players.
Well, if there were a serious American Secretary of State who understood, one, America's relationship with Russia, and two, its place in the Middle East, you could seize on this moment. I mean, a lot of the opposition in Syria depends very heavily on Erdogan's policy of supporting Islamists in Syria. This could, because of his electoral setback. And the negotiations with the Kurds that will take place, that could be a serious opening. With Iran, what seems to have happened with Obama is that he when he met the GCC foreign ministers and leaders at Camp David, he seems to have done a trade with them. He said, if you leave me alone on my Iran nuclear negotiations, I will leave you alone in Syria and Iraq. Not, we're going to have good relations with Iran, so maybe you should back off. Which is what probably, if he wanted peace in the region, probably what he should have said. Because we're going to have good relations with them. You should have good relations with them because they're not going to hurt you. But they didn't. He said he was willing to trade peace in Syria, Iraq for them accepting because he doesn't want any opposition to this nuclear deal, which may be the only deal he gets in his 8 years as president. And the Saudi King, I haven't been to Saudi Arabia in 10 years. So I don't really know enough to comment.
Okay. You were rather dismissive, I think, a couple of minutes ago about the U.S. Secretary of State. Could you expand on that? Because some people have felt he's tried very hard in various areas, notably a long and ultimately abortive effort to revive the two-state solution, to revive something on the Israeli-Palestinian front. We've seen him spend a lot of time with the Russians in the hope of achieving some degree of agreement on Syria. He may not be succeeding, but are you right to be so dismissive? Go on.
I'm not only right, I think I didn't hit it hard enough. In the Geneva talks, he went to Geneva with no plan. He just went there and hoped that the Syrians could sort it out amongst themselves. And that was never going to be possible. The only way of compelling those Syrians who came was the same way that the Saudis and the U.S. and the Egyptians and everyone else forced the Lebanese at Taif in 1988-89 to sign an agreement that they didn't want to sign. Nobody in Lebanon of those political leaders was happy with that arrangement, which meant it's probably an acceptable arrangement. They didn't like it. That's what needed to be done. You needed to have a plan that you with the superpower level accepted, and you were going to compel your clients to accept it. But that didn't happen. He went along to the meeting not prepared to deal properly. And I think that a lot of people are suffering because of that failure.
That's convincing. He's reactive rather than constructive.
Yes.
He has no plan. He hangs about in the fringes hoping that things will sort themselves out and that he'll be able to take some credit for that. That's a worrying picture. I'd like to bring this to an end by asking you about the situation with which most of us who have spent any time in the Middle East began, like the Arab-Israeli conflict, which for many, many years we saw as the central issue in the Middle East, that if it could be solved, so much else would fall into place, better regimes throughout the Arab world, that this solution of the Arab-Israeli question was a kind of key to the future of the region as a whole. That, in the last two or three years, during the Syrian crisis, and precisely because of the Syrian crisis and the emergence of ISIS and other fundamentalist elements, has suddenly begun to seem like ancient history, that this is no longer central, it's quite peripheral. And this is an extraordinary transition for people who spent 20 or 25 years of their journalistic lives concentrating on that issue. What, in retrospect, do you feel about that understanding of things? I'm not saying you shared it very well, but perhaps you didn't, but many, many, many did, including many journalists and many diplomats. Ask you about that.
Well, those journalists and diplomats were correct to the extent that from 1948 until very recently, Arab anger was focused on the Palestine issue.
Yeah.
In all Arab countries, the one thing that they'd all agree on was that the Palestinians should not have been expelled, and that the remaining bit of Palestine shouldn't be under occupation. But now there are bigger things to worry about, like survival. And all of this, I think, stems from the post-World War I settlement, which includes the establishment of a Zionist state in Palestine. But that's only one of many elements of that settlement. The other parts being the creation of the mini-states of what had been Syria, which nobody wanted. I mean, you have to remember that in 1918, when the United States sent the King Crane Commission to sample public opinion throughout the former Arab lands of the Ottoman Empire, which was Greater Syria and Mesopotamia, they found 80% support for united Syria, which means today's Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, as one state under Prince Faisal Hashemite. And then in Iraq, they found that the people wanted division. They didn't want the Kurds and the Arabs in one nation state, because you can't have a nation state of two nations, or it's very difficult to. If it was the old Ottoman Empire, fine, everybody jockeys with everyone else for power, but the Iraqis did not want that. So what do? They told the Syrians they can't have the unity that they all want, or the king that they want, and they told the Iraqis they have to have the unity that they don't want, and they're going to give them the king that they won't let the Syrians have, and the Syrians wanted him and the Iraqis didn't. And when Faisal got to Baghdad, there was an uprising, and 10,000 people were killed in one summer by the British to crush that uprising, by Kurds and Arabs. I think all of these problems come out of that settlement and the imposition of those terms of reference, those borders, that no one wanted, and created these security states that had no popular backing because the states were imposed in the first place. Israel is the only state with popular backing because the Israelis wanted their state. They support their state. But the others didn't. So how much longer can this solution last? I mean, it's unraveling. But I think, unfortunately, it's not unraveling by popular will or people democratically choosing to unite or divide. It's unraveling by force. And when it's all decided by force, it will be the most ruthless killers who will prevail. And I think the Middle East is going to be in terrible shape as a result of it.
I don't know how I can set it off with some pleasant words. I really don't. But I suppose we could finally ask, it's the same question in a way, whether the greater Syria that King Faisal, the very brief king, intended monarch of greater Syria, envisaged a decentralized, large decentralized kingdom, could ever come into being again, or whether the only option for greater Syria is some form of the caliphate, which Islamic State projects as the future for Arabs and Muslims. And finally, the final question in that is, does Islamic State have a future? Is that the future?
If the Islamic State is not controlled and contained, that probably will be the future for a large chunk of Syria and Iraq. How long, I don't know, but if it is contained, if, for example, Turkey were persuaded to close the border to all arms and recruits, it would slowly shrivel and and it would be easier for the Kurds, the Iraqi army, and the Syrian army to deal with it. But in the absence of that, I don't see that it's possible.
Well, we have seen the Kurds close up on the border, and much of that border that was pretty open has now been sealed off due to recent developments. Those can always be reversed. So I don't know whether we can end on a genuinely optimistic note, but let's say that we all hope for the best. Thank you very much. And we're open for questions. I suggest you address your questions not through me. That's an unnecessary complication, but directly to the author.
Please do.
Yeah, my name is Lucas. I'm from Berkeley College, student of international relations. When it comes to the Syrian regime and the top layer of the power structure under the Assad, what makes it distinct that people within these circles, top circles, did not or could not find alternative to Assad among themselves? In other words, is Assad for them so essential, and the loyalty between these people is so strong that there was no other solution, and he has stayed for so long?
Well, you have to look at the composition of the regime and how it came to be. So from 1946 to 1949, Syria was a parliamentary democracy. In 1949, the United States staged a coup under the Army Chief of Staff, General Hossein Zahid, Colonel Hossein Zahid. It was the first of many coups. He was overthrown some months later, and then the next man was overthrown. So throughout the 50s and 60s, there were coups about on average of every 18 months in Syria, which meant if you survived that, you were a very good conspirator. And the best conspirators turned out to be the Alawi officer corps, because they had survived 400 years of Ottoman Sunni oppression, and so they knew how to keep secrets. They were also the ones who were recruited into the army by the French, because the Sunnis did not recognize the French occupation of Syria, didn't want to serve, most of them. But the Alawis were very poor, and they didn't care whether it was the French or the Turks, so they served. By 1970, when Hafez al-Assad staged the very last military coup, he had in place such an effective security network that if anyone was disloyal, he disappeared. I mean, I used to know officials in the Syrian Ministry of Information, remember the man who was our guide in the October War 1973, called Marwan Hamway. He was once approached by someone who was thinking of a coup, and he said he wouldn't participate, but he didn't report to the person, so he spent the next 25 years in prison. So this regime was coup-proof. There was no way it was going to be overthrown from within, because everyone was spying on everyone else. So that's why it didn't happen. Please.
You haven't mentioned Yemen at all. I just wonder what you thought about Saudi involvement, which is no longer, in the case of Syria, covert, but it's if this is an overt action taken by Saudi, and it's much more on their doorstep. So, and again, it's the Saudi versus, or portrayed the Saudi versus
Well, see, remember, you have to remember, Saudi fought a war there before in the 60s against Nasser. They've been there before, and the Yemenis are once again stuck in a proxy war, then between Saudi Arabia and Egypt, now between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think it's terrible for the Yemenis if these outside powers are using them and keep bombing them and killing them. It's awful. And if I haven't spoken about Yemen tonight, there are two reasons. One, I didn't write a book about Yemen. And two, I've never been there, so I don't want to pretend I know very much about it.
But do you think it might spill out? That's why, because it's so much on Saudi's doorstep.
I don't know. Martin.
Well, I have been to Yemen once a long time ago, but that doesn't give me any claim whatever to expertise, obviously. But it seemed to me there was some evidence that the Iranians were worried that there were a bridge too far in Yemen. They were indicating a readiness to settle, one remove, or through intermediaries, and that even if you wanted to be optimistic, Yemen might be one of the areas where Saudis and Iranians decided they could back off. I offer that very, very speculatively, but I think there are bits of evidence that that may be the case.
Yeah. Charlie, I wanted to ask you something about the nature of Syria and the way in which, you know, you and I and Martin covered this place from the early years of the older Assad, and it's never been a particularly pleasant place to be or to report from. And for the locals, as we remember, any Palestinian or any Lebanese in the most innocent form, taxi driver, dreaded being commissioned to go to Syria because it was almost inevitable that he'd be hassled, possibly jailed. Almost everybody I knew in the area at the lowest level had spent time in a Syrian slammer, and they were lucky if it was only time they spent there. It was a dreadful, oppressive, and cruel regime. But the thing that's always struck me about it, and it applies to some extent to Iraq in parallel, is that under this kind of authoritarian, brutal aegis, the minorities that existed in that matrix in Syria, whether they were Christians or Ismailis or Alawites or Druze, and even Jews who still remained in Damascus and still remain, were able to function and to be relatively free of pogroms, discrimination, and to function freely. And the same was true to an extent in Iraq. The Shia thing was a complication which we haven't got time to go into. But it was true to an extent in Iraq, where a brutal regime kept the place secular and free from those kind of religious and ethnic quarrels which have now burst out onto the scene. Is it a truism to say that that part of the Middle East is Levant, that these minorities can only get on together, one, when the going is good, and two, when there is a fairly repressive and authoritarian regime, that otherwise it isn't going to work? And therefore we should, when we are revolted by the Syrian regime, also remember what it did preserve in Syria, you know, over the last, certainly close to a year.
Well, when Syria had its 3-year parliamentary democracy, the first prime minister was a Christian, Faisal Khoury. And there was no resentment about having a Druze chief of staff or a Kurdish chief of staff, Hosni Zaim. Even under the democracy, Syrian society generally is extremely tolerant. And people were able to exercise their social freedoms under the democracy and under the dictatorship. Because the dictatorship was, as you say, was secular. And I remember in the second year, 2012, second year of the uprising in Aleppo, people told me that their pact with the devil was they had their social freedoms in exchange for which they had no political freedom. And that was, for them, was enough, because most of them didn't want to play politics anyway. But they did want to have their schools, they did want not to cover their women. And this also gave a lot of social freedom to the Sunnis in the big cities, who under that kind of regime were able, at least socially, to act as they want. Politically, once you got involved in politics, if you were in any way perceived as a threat to the regime, then obviously your life, your days were numbered.
But the corollary in the sense of your answer, which I totally appreciate and agree with, and it's a question I think Martin raised, is why in this case did Bashar al-Assad react so overwhelmingly, brutally, to an uprising which was not religiously based, which was not Wahhabi, which was not jihadist.
But I think for the Assads, any opposition has to be crushed, whatever form it takes. They just didn't want.
That's what they do.
That's how they governed since 1970, and they didn't see any reason to change.
One in the back there.
Hello, I'm Fiona Stomach. I'm just an artist. So I'm not, you know, German.
Not just, surely.
Picasso was an artist.
I'm not Picasso. I have read an article maximisation of the profit. Is that the way forward to actually follow that kind of line of thought? I thought it was a very logical way forward.
I didn't read it, so I can't say, I don't know.
Basically, to change the thinking of young people with caliphate in showing the profit. You can't de-radicalise the people, but you can change things that they idolise.
If he's referring to foreign jihadis who were indoctrinated in other countries and could go, perhaps he's right, I don't know. But that doesn't really address the political problem itself in Syria or in Iraq. That's something else. The psychological motivations for outsiders who go and join, I don't want to go into because I'm not a psychologist. I don't.
Over.
Did the opposition or the oppositions make mistakes in your opinion?
Which ones?
Well, all of them, because it is a moving target because there are so many different oppositions, but.
But at one stage, Jane's Defense Weekly counted 1,500 rebel groups. I think there are probably fewer now because some of them have coalesced. Disunity has always been a problem. In even before the uprising, just generally the Syrian oppositionists, whether they were communists or Islamists, didn't really trust one another. And it was very easy for the regime to manipulate them. And this kind of general disunity continues. It probably was not helpful to their cause. And I think the Wahhabization of the uprising has enabled the regime to present to the outside world its original narrative, which originally wasn't true, but now is.
Somebody at the back there who was raising her hand. Yes, please.
Some Syrians blame Britain's refusal to get involved wherever they voted not to get involved in Syria, they blame that on the situation that we have now. You talked a little bit about America's foreign policy. What do you think of Britain's involvement and its actions, consequences on what we have today?
Well, Britain's involvement has been rather similar to America's. It has also been funneling weapons to the opposition and helping in the training of the opposition. The Parliament did vote against bombing Damascus over the chemical weapons issue, which probably turned out to be a good thing, because in the event the UN sent its inspectors in and they took the chemical weapons out, they may be coming back again, but for a time anyway, they were gone. And people in Damascus were not bombed and killed in order to achieve it, and those weapons, chemical weapons stores, which had they been bombed, some of them, those would have leaked into the atmosphere, and we don't know how many people would have been killed. So, in fact, I think the British Parliament spared the United States a potential catastrophe.
Yes, please.
You've somewhat presented the Syrian opposition as a kind of a Bashar self-fulfilling prophecy, but do you not think that, independent of how he would have reacted, this would have escalated to this extent? Because of Saudi Arabia, their relentless methods that they have used throughout the region to completely use other countries as pawns to get what they needed. This kind of representation of Saudi Arabia versus Iran over the regional kind of balance of power, I think that's also somewhat of an oversimplification. I mean, it's not been Saudi Arabia versus Iran. I mean, from the days of the revolution post-79, Saudi Arabia immediately were threatened by this concept of this kind of new government in Iran. So it's not a case of, you know, using other countries. It's just a sort of between the two, but it's something maybe Bashar had recognized that with Saudi Arabia and a dangerous Wahhabi methodology and a Salafist movement throughout the whole region and again in the West, that this is something that's going to happen rather than his own self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, I think that if he had not done what he did, if he had not shot everybody in the streets, if he had dismissed his cousin as governor the day that it happened, the day that he shot those people, the day that he tortured the children, he probably could have contained it, because it didn't begin that day as a national uprising. Syria was pretty quiet, and he had given an interview the month before saying that Syria was immune to the Arab Spring, because Syria was not a pawn of the West the way Egypt and Tunisia were, and so that there would be no objection to his continuing his. He couldn't have misread it more, by the way. So of course he's responsible too. No, everybody's responsible. But it doesn't mean we let anybody else off the hook.
If
I can ask one more question, and it's kind of related to it. How much does it credence to the argument that this radicalization of uprising is not coming out of external actors, but some actions of Bashar Assad from the beginning, when he, if I'm not mistaken, in late 2011, released certain figures, which were like Zahra Larouche, which were involved even before the uprising started, and were instrumentally used as an insurgent in Iraq, and therefore they started to organize along there.
It seemed that the prison releases of jihadis seems to have fed in both to Nusra and IS, and that, yes, that certainly is a factor.
Yes, please.
You covered a lot of ground, but one of the things when you were talking about what might help with this horrible situation that's going on was the situation on the Turkish border and the wish that maybe some of the petrol that's keeping the fires burning could get turned off. So I was just curious what you thought were the reasons that that hasn't happened and whether you thought it might change.
Well, one of the reasons is that the Peace and Development Party in Turkey, what are they called in English?
Justice.
They have an old relation from their days of opposition in Turkey, an old relationship with the Muslim Brothers in Syria. And they want to see, Erdogan personally wants to see Bashar al-Assad, the Alawi, go. Not Bashar al-Assad, dictator, because, I mean, Erdogan would like to have a dictatorship in Turkey, but he wants to see Assad the Alawi gone, and so he will go on and has been consistently helping the Islamist factions within the rebellion to thrive. Mm. Sorry.
I understand what you're saying about other things, but I'm very interested to ask a question about, I mean, the West often has made obviously tremendous mistakes in the Middle East, but equally the West, in the kind of the same self-centered way, likes also to self-flagellate itself, especially in academic circles and kind of concerned about the role of the Middle East. So, maybe the West is committing a lot of mistakes, but for example, how do we factor in the role of Russia and say, is Russia really, are we capable of bringing Russia to the table in any meaningful way, especially as you're saying that Syria is its only ally in the Middle East? And if so, what method would you use? Because in a way, you know, one of the first questions asked about how come people, they can see that they're not going to win, but how come they continue? But in a way, they don't see that they can't win, because in a way, you know, each one currently, I think, thinks that they might be able to prevail. And how do you bring the situation, the Lebanon situation that you talked about, where people will be able to see that they cannot win, and the Lebanon situation becomes possible? How do you see that?
There has to be an American-Russian dialogue in which both sides see that it's in their interests to put a stop to this war. I mean, I would like to see it stop primarily to end the agony of the Syrian people. The deaths, the dismemberments, the dislocation of a whole society. Okay, even if they're not interested in that, in their own interests of not further radicalizing the world, they should come to terms to contain this. And the U.S. should sit with Putin, as awful as he is, and find a way that they can have a common interest in containing the situation. Putin has his own worries about jihadists coming in through Central Asia. The U.S. has worries about al-Qaeda maybe coming back to the States and so forth. So at least they could start at that level and say, okay, now let's what are we going to do about Syria? Not we're upping our game. The Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks have now agreed they're going to send more and better weapons to the opposition. So Russia and Iran are sending troops, Iran sending troops, Russia sending more weapons and money to up the game for the regime. And so the war escalates because the weapons are getting more numerous and better. But that's not the way it should be going. It should be going exactly the opposite. I personally, from the very beginning, I would have had a total arms embargo on Syria, both sides. But that was never going to work.
No, but Russia was supplying arms.
It's, no, I'm saying they should They should have agreed nobody sends arms, including Russia. But anyway, that didn't happen. But they could start with that. That would be a very positive step forward. I'm sure every Syrian civilian would be thrilled with that.
Any more questions?
Fine.
Okay, maybe two more. One at the front and one at the back. Three. Sorry, I missed you. Sorry. All right. Three more. You start.
But Charlie, you mentioned American client states supporting the Islamists. Do you think the U.S. still has significant influence and power over these states, that they can actually make them shut that spigot off?
I think it certainly has. It's just not exercising it.
Okay.
No. I come from Switzerland, Mrs. Ackerman, and I think it's mainly a problem of market of weapons, you know. Like, everybody needs to sell weapons. I mean, it's so sad to say that, but no way you can make peace while people want to sell weapons. United States, England, Switzerland, the main countries.
Some truth in
that. Before Putin, I tell you.
Okay.
I don't particularly like Putin, but I mean...
Thank you for that. It's more a comment than a question. And the last question over there in the back.
Tony Kennett, just an independent person. You mentioned a moment ago, briefly, you touched on the subject of the weapons that are finding their way into the area. I wonder if you can tell us whether there's any capacity expected for ISIS to start producing their own of that type, or any instruments of war, or whether they are going to continue dependent on supplies from outside?
Well, for the moment, they have all the weapons they captured from the Iraqi army, which are substantial, in addition to which they are receiving sophisticated weapons from the Saudis and the Qataris through Turkey, in addition to which they're receiving training instruction from outsiders in the use of those weapons. Because not all, these people are mostly not trained soldiers. So I have not heard of them building a weapons factory. I mean, they may manufacture mortars the way all rebel groups can manufacture simple weapons of the poor. But the other weapons I haven't heard of anything. Maybe there is, but I haven't heard about it.
Thank you. Well, thanks everybody.
Thank you. the book is on sale in the bookshop. Yeah. Will you be signing next door, and then the garden and the bar?